From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. We know the air pollution from California wildfires is bad. We don't need science or a health official to tell us. Instinctively, we know that. We also know that vehicle emissions are bad for us. But is what happens after a wildfire worse than the vehicle emissions that we live with on a day-to-day basis? So that's a question that was raised by a claim by California Congressman Kevin McCarthy. And the PolitiFact California team decided to fact-check it. Reporter Chris Nichols is in the studio with the research and the rating. Hi, Chris. Glad to have you here.
Hi.
I think my descriptions are broad. When I say air pollution from wildfires, that's a big catch-all phrase. And vehicle emissions, likewise, is a big phrase. So would you be more specific about what Kevin McCarthy said and the words that he used?
Sure. And he was talking about air quality in general. The conversation also centered on the wildfires that have been raging throughout our state and what we should do with our forests. So all of this was sort of in the conversation when he made this statement. He said that, quote, what I have found because of these fires, there are studies that are showing they are producing more emissions than all of our cars are doing. And this was at a speech in Sacramento at the Public Policy Institute of California event earlier this month.
Let's listen to his voice and what he said.
I have a real concern about air quality because from where I come from, the bottom of all the mountains, and we collect all the way from San Francisco. What I have found because of these fires, there's studies that are showing they're producing more emission than all of our cars are doing.
Producing more emission. All right. So let's talk about where you began in researching the claim.
Sure. And part of the reason we decided to do this first was it just was sort of provocative. I mean, I think everybody has experienced the smoke that has blanketed much of California over the last several months and, you know, both seen it, smelled it, and really knows what is going on there as or can sense that it's a harmful thing, and it certainly is. Vehicle emissions may be a little more difficult to see, but certainly are problematic, too. The reaction we got when we spoke with experts, air quality experts and forestry experts, was, well, it sort of depends on which specific emissions you're talking about or that the congressman was talking about. We spoke, for example, with Sean Raffuse. He's an analyst over at the UC Davis Air Quality Research Center. His study focuses on emissions from fires. And he told us that McCarthy's statement is correct, but only for one category of emissions, and that is particulate matter. And that is a microscopic mixture of particles and liquid droplets. And when inhaled, these are very, very dangerous. They can affect the heart, lungs. They can trigger asthma attacks, aggravate chronic heart and lung diseases. So for that one particular emission, yes, fires produce more than cars combined, not just here in California, but across the nation. But Raffuse told us there's more to the story.
But that isn't to say that the cars aren't producing a lot of emissions. It's just that there are other kinds of emissions. So, for example, cars overall in the U.S. and in California as well are producing more greenhouse gases than the fires are. And they're producing large quantities of ozone precursors like oxides of nitrogen.
So I assume his study was one that McCarthy's office pointed to when you contacted them.
They pointed to a news article that quoted Raffuse from last year. He was cited in an NBC News article talking about the wine country fires and did make the same point that particulate matter is produced at a higher level by these fires than by our cars. But he also went on to say in the very same article that cars produce plenty of other emissions at a higher rate than fires, including the greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide, which he mentioned in that clip. So the congressman, he's right, at least if you look at this in a certain way, but he also leaves out a big part of the story.
Can we add the timing of this when he was in Sacramento and the fact that wildfires that had been studied would have been previous to what we were just experiencing in the north and through the Central Valley over the last number of weeks?
Right. He spoke August 15th, so a couple weeks ago, and I'm not sure that anyone really has good numbers on emissions from the current fires, but he, at least his office, cited an article based on last year's fires. But I think the same holds whether you're looking at fires this year or last year's. They emit different emissions at different levels than cars. And again, I think the congressman, you know, is on the right track to some degree. But in the end, we rated this half true because of the large omission about greenhouse gases and the fact that cars do produce those at a much higher amount.
It's a bit subjective for me to ask you whether his intent was to educate us about what's happening in the air we breathe or whether he was using this kind of information as an emotional plea in some regard, and maybe both.
Well, I think that, you know, the conversation, especially at that time a couple of weeks ago, and continues to be centered around what do we need to do with our forests and what kind of management, what kind of forest thinning or timber harvesting do we need to do to see if we can reduce the intensity of some of these fires? So to give him the benefit of the doubt, that may have been his focus. But I think it's no secret that McCarthy, the Trump administration in particular, who McCarthy is close to, are not fans of the tight California emission standards on vehicles.
You did some more fact-checking from that event. In fact, the last time we talked, you were on your way to his speech.
That's right. That's right. We also produced a fact check that's online now at politifact.com/California about a statement that McCarthy made saying that visa overstays account for about half of all the people who are in the country illegally. And we rated that mostly true. There are studies, they date back more than a decade now, that McCarthy essentially relied on. And I think, you know, we look for information that's a little more current a lot of the times. And we did find one study a little more current. I think it was 2014 that does mostly back up what he was saying. The numbers were closer to 40-42% of the unauthorized population sort of resulting from these visa overstays. So he was on the right track. Not a completely true, but a mostly true rating for that one.
You're listening to PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols, and you can find those fact checks on our website, as well as a link to the national PolitiFact page. Separately, you have been working in the newsroom on the recent ICE arrest, and in a story on Friday, it was reported that Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents arrested an undocumented man inside Sacramento County Superior Court. And that prompted concerns from immigrant rights groups. You didn't do a fact check per se about this, but talk more about the research.
Right. We did the initial story last week because it was such an unusual arrest to have a federal agency, not just at the local courthouse, but inside a courtroom and make an arrest like that. Was really, for Sacramento, according to attorneys we've spoken with, was unheard of. So after that initial story, we started asking about just the legality of that. Where do federal powers end? How expansive are their powers to make an arrest anywhere? And so we spoke with UC Davis Law School Dean Kevin R. Johnson, and he had a few comments about those powers.
It's hard to say that the state court judge has any legal authority over the federal government in that circumstance, but at the same time, it raises an array of tensions between the state and federal government that have provoked a fair amount of concern.
A fair amount of concern and reaction by a number of people. So continue.
Right. As you mentioned, immigrant rights groups, attorneys have been very outspoken. They've criticized this. They feel that this has a chilling effect on the undocumented community, that it will prevent people from showing up at a courthouse either as a witness to testify in a court case, to seek justice when they're the victim of a crime, or even simple matters such as paying a parking ticket. I should mention that when we spoke to ICE, their spokesman said that the agents did have a federal criminal arrest warrant for the undocumented man. That that does make a difference, sort of expands where any of these agents can go to make the arrests, according to the attorneys we spoke with.
You did talk to an attorney from the immigration clinic at the McGeorge School of Law, and I think that perspective is important, too.
Right. And that was Blake Nordahl. And he told us that this is not entirely unheard of in California. We have seen recent reports in Fresno, at a local court there, of ICE arrests at the courthouse. He also talked about this happening under the Obama administration.
There were reports of it happening, you know, back in 2012, 2013, but there was public outcry about it. I read one example of a couple was being married and were arrested, and so that was down in Southern California. And so there was public outcry, and the practice stopped, and it has been restarted in the last 2 years.
So that article is already posted as well.
That's right. The initial article is posted, and we'll have a follow-up later this week.
I'm going to add, Chris, that yesterday, Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler talked with the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court about that ICE arrest, and she talks about it as an example of her view of this current practice. So we're going to listen to a bit of that interview with the Chief Justice, Tony Contil Sakaue.
Hearing about the most recent arrest by ICE inside a Sacramento County courtroom while an accused man represented by his attorney was in the midst of litigating his state law violation, I continue to believe is disruptive. There can be no question it's disruptive. Also, I think it's short-sighted into the message it sends into the communities about being able to come to court to resolve your disputes. And third, I think it's counterproductive to safety and to people's respect and loyalty to the law. So I continue to be against that. I continue to ask that we be placed, that mean courts, be placed on the sensitive areas list that we not see arrests in courthouses, let alone courtrooms.
And that, again, was the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court talking with Ben Adler.
And looking forward, when we spoke with ICE, it seems to be that this is a practice that they have no intention of stopping, that this, they say that California's sanctuary laws have essentially forced them to make arrests at public places like courthouses. They say that the state laws that limit cooperation between local law enforcement and their federal immigration agents have given them no other option but to take action such as this. So if this happened years ago and there was a public outcry and it stopped, there does not seem to be plans to stop this currently.
All right, Chris. Well, thanks for joining us. And you want to let everybody know where they can find more PolitiFact info?
They can go and find those fact checks at politifact.com/California.
All right. Thanks again, Chris.
Thank you.
There is one more piece of Ben Adler's interview that we want to share with you. Ben asked about Governor Brown signing into law the bail bond reform legislation, meaning the end of the bail process in California once a review system is established. So here is the reaction from the California Supreme Court Justice Tony Contil Sakaue when Ben asked how big a change this bill turned into law will be.
I think it's a transformative change. I think it is a major change in California and really as an example to the rest of the nation.
It was your framework, the Judicial Council's framework, that formed the basis of what ended up in this bill 2 years later. What were your goals as you began this process trying to come up with a replacement system?
Well, in 2016, early 2016, I questioned the bail process and thereafter appointed 10 judicial officers and one court executive officer to study bail with no preconceived notion of an outcome. But I asked different jurists from rural counties, urban counties, large counties, small counties, jurists who were, one was a local law enforcement previously, another was a DA, another was a public defender, to come together and ask questions about our bail system. They studied it for a year. They had all stakeholders come and present answers to preformed questions so everyone had the same base of information and starting point. And then together, this group of 11 who started out very diverse in terms of their views of bail came out with unanimously with 11 recommendations that were later embodied in SB 10. I thought it was important that judges, the experts who set bail every day in the courts in California, be the ones to study it. There hadn't been a study of actual, the data of actual work and how the bail process worked. So we studied it. And we came out with this report. We knew it was a three-branch solution. There was nothing we could do alone. But we shared the report with all three branches of government and the public, and it is embedded in SB 10.
Now, the new system is going to give judges a lot of discretion. Some folks would say a lot of power. Some folks might say too much power to decide who should remain behind bars, who is a risk to the public or a flight risk. And there is going to be 58 different systems, right? 58 different counties, with each coming up with its own system for pretrial release and assessments and keeping track of folks who are out. Why is this system the right system as opposed to any other possible replacement or the existing system?
Well, I'll start with that question last. The existing system, all agreed in the legislature and elsewhere, was broken, that people should not be judged on the amount in their wallet. And so this new procedure under SB 10 actually looks at the person's risk assessment, risk to the public and their ability to return to court for the orderly administration of justice. And while there may be 58 different pretrial services, the framework that governs all 58 counties and their pretrial services and the assessments and the time for release and the time for pre-detention hearings are all governed by this bill. So while there will be changes in culture, because every community is different, there will be a universal structure. There will also be surveys and data and oversight and accounting in order to take it back to the legislature to fix those aspects of the bill that may not be working as we perceive them to work.
Are you comfortable with 58 different systems as opposed to one system?
I'm comfortable with 58 courts being serviced by their elected constitutional judicial officers in all of those counties who bring education and experience and thoughtfulness to their job every day. Judicial officers have discretion in sentencing, in conditions of probation, in a number of things that happen in their courtroom every day. Their ability to use their discretion, using a risk assessment tool as part of the factors that they will consider in the release of someone, to me, is something I am very comfortable with.
You've addressed some of the criticism from the bail industry about why this bill's bad, but there are groups on the left, progressive groups, who really have fought hard to end cash bail, but think this bill, again, gives too much power to law enforcement and to judges, and that this will very possibly end up incarcerating more people than the current system. What would you say to them?
One side of the critics say, this bill will result in mass incarceration of people of color. Another group of opponents of this bill say, everyone's going to be let out. It cannot possibly be both. This bill is the product of 2 years of balanced study, negotiation, and addressing issues and working out negotiations. It embodies all 11 recommendations of the pretrial detention work group. These are judges who set bail every day. People have said it's not perfect. We don't know because we've never launched it. But it's better than the system we have now, and it's something that can be improved upon in the future. And anything that judges people less by their money and more by an assessment of whether they will appear back in court and are a danger to public or the victim is infinitely better.
Opponents have raised some questions about whether this bill is constitutional, this law is constitutional because of a right to bail in the Constitution. Could you address that concern?
Well, I know that's been a concern out there, and I think that it's going to be something that may or may not be litigated, so I can't really opine on it publicly. But I also realize that many other courts and states and the United States Constitution has looked at this, and that's a subject that I suppose we'll have to litigate when it comes before us.
Would you have to recuse yourself on that because you've lobbied so much for this bill?
I would certainly take a look at removing myself.
And that was California Supreme Court Justice Tani Kantil Sakaue talking yesterday with Cap Radio's Ben Adler. You can find more coverage of the new bail reform law at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.